Hello, everybody. I'm Paul Menzel.
And I'm Jim Conlon, and we're the Old Dogs.
If you got about 20 minutes, grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and join us.
In this episode, the Old Dogs ramble about euphemisms. You know, the art of saying something nice when you mean something bad. We report on a quiet, small-town guy with a surprising legacy. We present another edition of Ads and Fads. We chuckle over one of Elon Musk's famous euphemisms. We bring you an article about fears, including some fears you may not know you have. And we explain why, if you want to colonize Mars, you're gonna need bugs. The Old Dog's conversation is with Dennis Elmer. You may forget his name, but you won't forget his music. Stay with us. Paul, you look like you're ready to tell me what's on your mind.
I thought you'd never ask. We have a pod nugget in today's episode about euphemisms. In this particular situation, a euphemism for a rocket that exploded.
Right, yes.
And, you know, they started thinking, euphemisms, I guess, are helpful. They're helpful if you want to avoid blunt language. They're helpful if you want to tone down the subject. And where my thoughts were going is the whole process of growing old. There's a lot of euphemisms that accrue to that process.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone comes up to you and say, "Hey, you're looking good," right away you think, "Oh no, what's wrong? Why am I looking that bad?"
Yeah. You never hear that when you're 35, right? "Hey, Paul, you're looking good."
Yeah, well, I got that in my 20s, too. I remember 12 one time. No, but you know what I'm talking about, because the process of getting older, as we've both discussed, is not for sissies. There are some challenges associated with it. And so I think there's some comfort in euphemisms for getting old. And
yeah, I have thoughts. I better get them out quick because I'm feeling, I don't know, like I've got one foot in the grave.
Ah, and the other on a banana peel, right?
That's right. Really, I agree with you. I think that there is a lot of concern that people our age have about what's next, what's coming up next. And so we want to kind of reassure each other that we're still okay somehow. We're okay. So we'll say, yeah, you're looking good.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think we look to language to soften this process of getting old, because with getting old, every morning in the mirror, there's no denying those wrinkles and that you are in that group of the aged. So don't slap me in the face with it.
Fine. Yeah.
You know, you look peppy for someone your age.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll take that.
Yeah. You talked about looking at yourself in the mirror. I got to tell you that I don't usually look that closely. And I think, you know what? I think of myself as probably looking like I did when I was 45, right?
Oh, yeah. Then,
but on a really bad day,
I might look at myself in the mirror and think, wait a second, who is that guy?
No, listen, I look in the mirror and I go, "Oh my God, I've turned into my father."
Yeah.
Yeah, there, that's, yeah.
Yeah, but still, Paul, I would say that you're awfully spry.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. And you don't look your age either.
Oh, really? What age
do you look? Wink, nudge, nudge. This is a somewhat familiar story from the Washington Post about a reclusive guy who lived in a small town named Hinsdale, New Hampshire. He lived simply and kept to himself. His name was Jeffrey Holt.
Holt had been a social studies and driver's education teacher. When he retired, he moved to a trailer park where he was hired as a handyman and groundskeeper. He wore old clothes that he never seemed to replace.
He was content to spend most of his time with his collection of die-cast cars and model trains. He owned a real car, but, you know, he didn't use it. He preferred to ride his riding lawnmower to the Walmart if he needed to shop.
His sister said that his philosophy was to make sure that nobody ever noticed you. He said, "Don't stand out. Don't do anything, or anybody will be able to criticize you."
He told the owner of his trailer park that he'd made some investments and that they were doing well. You know, that was an understatement.
Right. Holt died in 2022, and he left an estate of $3.8 million. In his will, he left his fortune to his hometown of Hinsdale. It was to be used to benefit the town's education, recreation, health, and cultural activities. I didn't hear any mention of his sister there, did you, Paul?
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, he did check with his sister that she didn't need any money.
Oh.
But this was before he made out his will, and he only had maybe a couple of friends and his sister, so the town gets it.
What a story. In this 17th edition of Ads and Fads, we focus on a pudgy spokesperson for a line of edible products. This character was very animated when he was first introduced in 1965.
Within 3 years of first appearing, this character had a recognition factor of 87% among shoppers. He was also receiving fan mail and requests for autographed pictures.
To solve our Ads and Fads puzzle, name the company the character represented and the full name of the character. We'll give you the answer later in the episode.
This note from the Houston Chronicle for November 25th. Starship, the rocket that Elon Musk and SpaceX hopes to use for interplanetary travel, has twice exploded during test flights. In other words, it's unsafe at any speed. It may even be unsafe sitting on the launch pad.
Elon Musk, as we know, is not one to admit a mistake. So the SpaceX rocket didn't explode or turn into a fireball. Instead, the rocket experienced a rapid, unscheduled disassembly.
You know, for once I'd like to hear Musk say, I blew it.
Yeah.
Instead, he comes up with a world-class euphemism, a rapid, unscheduled disassembly. That ranks right up there with being economical with the truth and genuine imitation leather.
Yeah, this failure to launch is most likely a result of the rush to build and test a rocket that is the largest ever built. A byproduct of this rush is a disregard for safety at SpaceX. There have been 600 injuries reported, ranging from loss of limbs to loss of life.
Meanwhile, I expect there will be some resignations from the astronaut corps before they experience their own unscheduled disassembly.
FDR famously said, "There is nothing to fear but fear itself." I guess this means that fearing fears is still acceptable. Well, thanks to the website DictionarySkoop.com, we present some recognized fears that you can fear.
Coulrophobia is the fear of clowns. If you've ever read Stephen King's It, you may have the same problem.
Mm-hmm. Anthophobia is abnormal fear of flowers. I'm not sure what trait of a flower is scary. It certainly won't chase you.
Xanthophobia is the fear of the color yellow in any form, which means no bananas, mustard, or Cheez-Its in their house.
Arithmophobia is the fear of numbers, a fear that certainly doesn't add up.
And finally, we have the mother of all phobias, phobophobia. This is quite literally the fear of phobias, the fear of fear itself.
And since we've come full circle, I fear this pod nugget is done, Paul. Okay, here are the Ads and Fads answers. The company was Pillsbury, and the character was Poppin' Fresh, the Pillsbury Doughboy, still going strong after 55 years. In his career, the Doughboy has represented 50 Pillsbury products across more than 600 commercials and ads, making him one of the hardest-working characters in show business.
Shouldn't that be Dough-Person?
Dough-Person, and I wonder if he gets residuals.
Well, probably. They're probably fictional, too. he gets cartoon checks. The New York Times, in a November article, wrote about the current planning for an eventual mission to Mars. This will be a long-term stay, which means the pioneers on Mars will be growing their own food.
In preparation,
NASA is working with some university researchers to find out what's necessary to turn Martian soil into a garden plot. Of course, you need water and sunlight, but there is an ingredient that may be surprising. You need insects.
You know, one candidate for the astronaut insects are black soldier flies. Their larvae are voracious eaters. They could consume astronaut food waste, and their excrement, called frass, is a good fertilizer, which would be added to the Martian soil to produce more food. And suddenly, we have a food cycle.
Well, this is part of a larger research project that will be exploring what is needed for a space environment independent of Earth. In addition to food, systems will be needed for refreshing air and water and processing waste.
Whatever else is developed over the next decade, it is certain that the vehicle heading to Mars will contain some combination of insects and bacteria to make the Martian soil more productive for growing food.
You know, Paul, I suppose that means they're going to have specialized astronauts in charge of pest control.
Well, they should. I also noticed cockroaches are on this list.
Oh, yeah.
Or mosquitoes, yeah, for that matter.
Yeah, inevitable. Why should Martian colonists miss out on the pleasures of cockroaches and mosquitoes? If you have or someone you know has memory issues, you'll be glad to know about Dennis Elmer. He's a man who pursued two very different careers, one of which is as a musician. Over time, he became acquainted with folks in their later years who couldn't always remember faces or dates, but always seemed to remember their favorite tunes. He turned that into a career that's made the lives of a lot of seniors a lot happier.
To get started, how about you fill us in on your early musical career?
Sure. About age 7, took lessons, quit, and then decided I was interested again. So at about age 8, I took lessons and quit. And then I decided, okay, well, I really want to play rock and roll, and that's not what they're teaching me. So I'll take lessons a little bit longer, but then I'll quit. And I did. And I did, in fact, at that time, start playing rock and roll, which is a different concept from the way that music was being taught at that time.
Oh, yeah.
So what I do is kind of a merger between the legitimate music styles and the popular music styles.
But you were in several bands in your 20s, right?
Oh, yeah. In fact, when I was playing through high school and then and in college, I went to college in North Louisiana, and the party scene was much better in South Louisiana back at home. And so it was profitable and productive for me to make a weekend trip home and split gas with some guys and play a job or two on a weekend and then go back to college. That was a regular weekend event. And it certainly taught me a lot about entertaining, and it taught me a lot of tunes. It was primarily the country club circuit and the wedding circuit and the dinner music circuit.
That sounds like the reality of being a working musician.
Well, yes. And then a little later on in my early 20s, I did play as a duo with a drummer. We were playing dances, and we were playing various kinds of weddings. And goodness, at that time, the money was better for musicians in Louisiana in counted dollars than it is today, with no ramification for inflation. Just the dollars we were earning then are greater than the dollars that many musicians can earn working gigs here in Nashville right now.
Yeah. Plus, you can sleep late.
Well, that's true. I've never been a late sleeper.
Ah, okay. Well, at some point in your life, you decided that the life of musician wasn't what you wanted to concentrate on. You developed another career. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
I studied journalism and marketing as well. And those backgrounds have been very, very useful, not only in professional application in the business world, but also in the music, because you have to know how to communicate with people. You have to know how to write succinctly. You have to know how to catch people's attention and stimulate their imaginations and do it all legitimately and ethically. So that was a really good background and a really good merger of skills. Coming out of college, I was the first managing editor of the Slidell Daily Times, because prior to that, there was a publication twice a week. And when I joined, the role then was to convert that from a two-time-a-week operation to a five-time-a-week operation. Slidell was at that time a very small town. Now it's a very, very busy suburb of New Orleans. But at the time that I was there, the unspoken partnership was that, hey, you need a job where you're going to get a lot of experience, and we're not going to pay you a whole lot of money. So it probably should work out pretty well. And it did for a period of time. And after that, I went to the professional conversion was from news writing and news and management of a newsroom to learning how to sell advertising for the same publication. And then made a transition to radio advertising. And then later on into executive recruiting.
But at some point, you decided to leave recruiting. And that brings us to your current undertaking, which is fascinating. It's something called Elmer's Tunes. Tell us about it. How did this idea come to you?
I've learned through marketing that what you want to do is, in order to attract people's attention and to establish a name for yourself, you need to have some aspect of uniqueness. You need to be identifiable. You need to establish a name and a presence. You need to repeat that and repeat that and repeat that. And repeat that, and repeat that again. And so I'm living in Nashville right now. I have been for the last 33, 34 years. And here in this town, I mean, you would say this is like Music Central, right? This is music. This is known as Music City. Greatest place to be for a musician, right? Wrong. It's the worst place to be for a musician. There are probably 10 times as many musicians as there are music jobs in this town. And so I knew that I wanted to be essentially a soloist. I knew that I wanted to play and sing. I knew that I wanted to have something to do with primarily the tunes that I know is from the time that I grew up, and maybe a little bit earlier, maybe a little bit later, but kind of centered in the 70s. I knew that I'd have to create it myself because the marketplace wasn't going to come to me specifically. And so that was the reason for creating an image and a persona behind the music. And so then as a marketer, you look for your audience. Like, where is my audience? Well, my audience is not going to be in clubs in Nashville. Nashville's a guitar town. I'm a piano player. Plus, most of the working musicians are probably in their 20s and their 30s. And stage presence there is extremely positive, whereas I deal with the fate that I've been given. And I found out through sampling my work in various audiences, the clubs here in this town, you know, you it's probably three times as hard to sell a job as it is to play a job. But in the jobs that I was finding, the jobs that I was playing, I could see that the greatest reception that I got was with seniors. And that shouldn't be, you know, hard to figure out, because I can relate with them quite easily. I think of my audience as probably being mid-80s, kind of centered there. It is then a matter of playing the tunes that I know and then going back about 10, 15 years from the center of the tunes that I grew up with in order to play the swing tunes of the 40s and the early rock tunes of the 50s. And make sure that it's a well-rounded package for folks who may not have a lot of other outlets in order to find music and entertainment.
Well, let's look at that a little bit. You're targeting folks who are suffering from dementia, because there has been a lot of research done on how music can penetrate that fog of dementia. Can you tell us a little bit about that and some of the experiences you had reaching people?
Oh, sure. For example, there is a man who has attended several of my events, and he has days when he can remember and days when not quite so much. So, for example, his caregiver told me, we were out in the car. I took him for a ride about 4 hours. We got back home, and he couldn't remember that we had been on the ride. But he did remember the piano player. And then the more I've read and the more I've studied about music therapy, the more I see, not only does the opening of memory occur at the time of listening, but also it is a pathway that can remain open for an hour or longer, where that person can become much more lucid and much more communicative.
Dennis, I think that that's extraordinary. I'm a musician. I've played around Houston for a long time, and I know quite a few musicians who do play for seniors, senior centers, and so on, and memory care centers. But I don't know anyone that has done the research behind it like you have. I'm curious to know what prompted you to do actual research into it so that you could reach that particular audience even better.
Well, I think when you're interested in it, then you gravitate toward it. I must tell you that when I was a younger person, I just really did not want to be around the geriatric set. It just didn't appeal to me. It just didn't. It's like, who are these people? You know, if I'm 20 and they're 80, like who? I don't get it. And the closer I get there, the more I realize, you know what? They're people too. And they are inside the same person that they were 30 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years ago. That's the same person inside.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to do our best to touch it.
Do you ever have times when people will actually, I know you alluded to this, so they actually sing along with you? They recognize a tune that means something to them and they will sing along with you?
I encourage it.
You encourage it.
I want to say I encourage it. I also want to see feet tapping.
Yeah.
Even if it's a little, you know, touch on the shoulder. I feel like I've accomplished something if somebody's just kind of, even if I get a little, something is being touched.
Yeah. And you say that this can last with people with Alzheimer's or dementia, that this effect of having music played for them can improve their cognition for hours after the event.
I wouldn't want to exaggerate that, but yes, that's uh-huh. right. I mean, I've heard of it lasting an hour.
Yeah.
So for people that are listening, how can they access this music? I understand you have, from your website, you can access some streaming versions of your music. And I guess you also do live shows. Tell us about all that.
That's right. I make it available online by subscription. And there's a lot of free stuff on there as well. But the regular members are on a subscription, and that's where the long form programs play. I provide fresh content 8 times a month, and it is at elmerstunes.com. Elmerstunes, ELMERSTUNES.com.
Well, Dennis, thanks for joining us. You've found a terrific DAC 3 that's helping a lot of seniors who are suffering from dementia.
When I retired from recruiting, I knew I don't want to retire and do nothing. I want to do something. I want to have a purpose. I want to have a meaning. I want to participate, contribute something.
Like what you've been hearing? How about sharing the joy with your friends? We can always use more listeners. There are more episodes on the way, so stay tuned and keep howling at the moon.